Welcome. Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John Cozy. It's always good to have John back. John's got a new article. He calls it Economics and Armchair Psychology. He quotes a man named Henry Hazlitt. And Henry had to say, economics is haunted by more fallacies than any other study known to man. John, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Oh, it's great to have you back. Let me quote what you say at the end of your article. I had it. Where's the quote I wanted?
It ought to be.
Oh, let me see if I can find it.
That's the end.
it was a great quote at the end. Oh, dear. I'll let you start off, and I'll find it, and then I'll jump in and read you a quote.
I don't know where to start now.
Well, I will say this, and I mentioned to you in an email how economist Michael Hudson likes to write about and talk about junk economics, the kind of stuff you get from talking heads on the U.S. business channels or other channels on the BBC and the other corporate or government-dominated channels, most of them, where they tell people what they want you to know, not what you need to know.
Well, you know, that's true of everything that you get in college and school in the mainstream press anywhere. They don't tell you what you need to know. They tell you what they want.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, they tell you what they want you to think you want to know.
And usually when you're a little bit younger, especially in college where you can enter as a teenager, you just may not know the difference. Well, it's a different world today than the one you and I grew up in, John. I didn't have a computer. No online connections. You couldn't jump online and find some good sources and find out what was really happening. You depended on television, which in my early days, there was none. And then there were three channels, and they only operated so many hours a day. And there was radio, and there were the newspapers and other print publications. So you only got the party line. You certainly didn't have easy ways to check out the truth. You had to do some digging.
Well, that's still true.
It's still true. It's absolutely true. But it's easier now.
I don't know if it is or not. There's a lot of bad stuff.
Oh, it takes a little effort to separate the wheat from the chaff. I agree with
that. I mean, I spend most of my day separating the wheat from the chaff, and the pile of chaff is awful high.
Oh, it is. I mean, it drowns out the other stuff. I guess it's like panning for gold. You go through an awful lot of worthless stuff to get to the few kernels that you want to get your hands on. Something like that. I found the quote. Let me just give you the quote at the end. Will you say, economics is not about economy. It is a way of organizing society. Our economists have restructured an old social order. We live in a neo-feudal world where the elite rentier group lives in manor mansions and everybody else is a serf.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
That's the way it is indeed.
And it's going to be that way, you know. I've come to the conclusion that there is no hope. Once a small group of people gain access to, I don't know, 90% of the Earth's resources, there's no way you can overthrow them. There's just no way to do it. And that's exactly what happened. I get kind of sick in the stomach. I see what's going on in Europe. We have, you know, a conservative, arch-conservative who was schooled in East Germany, now is chancellor of Germany. She might just as well be wearing the brown shirt every day. I mean, it doesn't make any difference. Okay, and what's she doing? Carrying the water for bankers. And then we have in France a supposed socialist. What's he doing? Carrying the water for the bankers. It doesn't make any difference to the bankers get all the water.
John, I absolutely agree with you. You're talking about Angela Merkel in Germany and Francois Hollande in France, and you got David Cameron in Britain. It goes on and on and on, and you got this phony government that was just put together in Italy where the Italian people were angry, angry as hell, and they wanted nothing to do with the old order. So what have they got? They got the old order in new clothes.
Yeah, I thought that happened. So, you know, look what happened. You know, look what the Venezuelans did. I mean, yeah, they elected Maduro, but by a scant margin. So how do you make any sense out of that?
I have a hard time making sense out of that. I've written so much about Venezuela, especially, I did when I began writing an awful lot, then I did it sporadically, but in the last, 4 or 6 months or so, going back to last October's election, and then Hugo Chavez's fourth cancer operation that scared the dickens out of me, it turned out to be for good reason, because he's gone now. I wrote so many articles on Venezuela, and it shocked me that the Venezuelan people, they know the benefits that they have, the great majority are greatly deprived. I thought they would vote more strongly for Maduro than they did for Chavez, just to get the message across that they're not going to give up the social benefits that took so long to win, and they've got them, and they help so much, and they're not going to let a neoliberal, subservient to Washington guy come in and take them all away from them. But it was, I think, about a 1.7% difference, and
yeah.
Maduro won fair and square.
Well, yeah, sure he did, but, I mean, you know, and then I had a laugh with the Maduro's going to neighboring countries to garner support, which is fine, and his opposition's going to neighboring countries to claim that the election was fraudulent. I laughed out loud. I wrote a piece some time ago. You may remember it. I called it Demented Democracy. What happens nowadays when there's an election, even before the votes are counted, the opposition, the losing party, claims fraud. I mean, they don't even wait for the votes to be counted, and they're claiming fraud.
The script is written in advance, John.
Yeah, you know. So, I mean, what's the point of all this? And then, you know, I look at the Pakistani election yesterday. Okay, I guess that's an improvement. I don't know.
Oh, I don't think very much.
But a center-right coalition party isn't much of an improvement over a right-wing party, a right-wing corruption party. I mean, you know, and what's with people when they go to the polls? I mean, I don't know.
John, it's shocking. Pakistan, they turned out in record numbers despite threats.
Yeah.
Threats by the, Pakistani Taliban wing, or whatever they call themselves, maybe different groups. I mean, they threatened people not to go out because they knew the whole process was rigged, and people died, and a lot of people were hurt in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
But they still turned out, and they didn't realize that Pakistan, since it came into existence, is literally a military that masquerades as a country.
Yeah, well, yeah, but that, I mean, that, you know, it's just historical ignorance, and the historical ignorance has to be blamed on, well, the world's universities and colleges and schools, and the world's historians. I mean, you just have to put it right where it belongs. They don't tell people the truth. You know, everything that's happening in the Middle East, and most of what's happening in Africa, you know, was caused by the French and the British. I mean, Pakistan was never a country. Syria was never a country. Lebanon was never a country. Jordan was never a country. The First World War, the British and French decided they wanted the resources of the Middle East, and they carved things up to suit them in the hell with the people who live there. And now that hell is coming back to haunt them. But now, you know, it's the guys who are fighting for their independence that are the bad guys, the terrorists. You know, and the guys who made this damn mess are the so-called upright international community. Every time I hear that word, I want to spit.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
I mean, you know, our American diplomats, we have the international community on our side. What international community? France and Britain?
Yeah, France and Britain and America. It's like the UN, John. You've got 193 countries. I think that's about the right number, maybe 194. But only one country usually matters, and that's America, because it has a veto in the Security Council. So if 193 vote yes and America votes no, one against 193 wins. Some
yeah,
system.
Yeah. That's right. You know, I don't know why a Secretary General of the so-called UN doesn't say, "Hey, we need a name change."
We need a restructuring. I mean,
well, if we can't restructure it, we at least need a name change.
Oh, indeed. And unfortunately, the secretary generals or secretaries general, maybe both of those terms are correct. They're usually U.S. imperial tools. It's certainly true of the current one, Ban Ki-moon, and his predecessor, Kofi Annan, and I guess a number of others as well. I mean, America has final say on who gets the job, and they damn well better support U.S. interests, or they won't stick around too long.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, I don't know why the blogging community, the internet community, the good people with the ability to draw caricatures and stuff don't, you know, draw caricatures about Mr. Moon mooning. You know, high school and college kids go mooning all the time. I don't know why they don't do it for him. I wondered, you know, the election in South Carolina, why some enterprising blogger didn't draw a cartoon of Sanford hiking, you know, in the Appalachian Mountains, and have a picture of a man hiking with no pants. You know, I mean, you could have made a mockery out of him, but nobody did it. I don't understand Americans. I just don't.
Yeah, I get frustrated too, John. I was asked shortly before airtime. There's a some kind of a march taking place in a big eastern U.S. city. I knew nothing about it, and the question I was asked was, will it do any? I'm not certain what it was for, whether it was against austerity measures or the imperial wars or whatever, but a march that was taking place. Again, I was asked, will it have any effect? And I said, it won't accomplish anything. And I have an article I'll put out tomorrow. It was about yesterday in at least six Israeli cities. Israeli citizens marched.
Demonstrating, yeah.
Yeah, for social justice. Justice.
That's a little late, don't you think?
Well, they did it in summer 2011 and 2012, and they accomplished nothing. They accomplished nothing, because you can't go out on a march and then go home to dinner and relax and go to work the next day.
I learned a new word, a neologism, the other day that's become prevalent on the internet. You may not have heard it, but it's a word that means exactly what you've just described. It's called slacktivism. S-L-A-C-K-T-I-V-I-S-M, slacktivism.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
You know, and it's a good word. A lot of the stuff that's going on is slacktivism. I mean, you put your name on a petition, you know, you go to a rally or something, and then, as you say, yeah, you go home and you carry on as though nothing happened.
And you feel like you're in the fight for change, but you're actually doing nothing at all.
Nothing at all, yeah. It's a great word, selectivism.
I think it's a terrific word. I think it's a great word. I wish I thought of it. But, you know, there were times in the past in America when it was just the opposite. I mean, you could go back 100 years. I mean, women fought for the right to vote. It took many years. It took until, one of the amendments, maybe it was around 1920 or so, and I think it began in the 19th century, the suffragettes. You had the labor activists fighting for labor rights and civil rights activists and the abolitionists back in the 19th century. Well, they didn't get it by going out to a few protests and then going home to dinner. They did it because they weren't going to accept anything less than that, and they kept fighting for it, and in many cases, successes took over from what earlier ones didn't accomplish. And they were the ones who got it done. It takes a long haul struggle to get any kind of change.
But I don't know what why people change. I mean, I just don't. But when I was a boy, my father was a coal miner in eastern Pennsylvania, and he was part of a union activist group. Okay, the coal companies had mounted gendarmes to put these people down. And I remember my father and his group going out with pickaxe handles. And they took down more horses and coal and iron cops than you would imagine. And, of course, they won the fight, but it was a hard fight. We don't see anything like that in America anymore.
Yeah. The last time we saw it was the anti-Vietnam War protest, 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and you know what makes me mad? The killing in America is just enormous. And, we don't care about the killing. And it was pretty obvious the last couple of weeks. We don't care about the killing. Four people got killed in Boston. 30 people got killed in a company explosion in Texas. Texas faded from the television screen the next day. Why? That was a corporate caused disaster. The Boston thing stayed on and on and on and is still on. We don't care about the killing. The 30 people in Texas, we don't give a damn about them. Four people in Boston, we pretend to care about them, but we don't. What we care about is catching the guys who did it and punishing them. That's all we care about. There's a corporation to catch in Texas. Nobody's going to do that. Okay? But there are, two guys in Boston. Boy, we would if we could. I'm sure that the Republicans in Congress would if they could put up two crosses on Capitol Hill and crucify those people.
Well, John, I agree with you. Literally, when an accident happens like the blast in Texas, it certainly wasn't the first one, and it won't be the last. I mean, this is serious stuff, and it's because of government and corporate complicity to simply disregard safety regulations, the welfare of workers, the welfare of people living in the community, and so on. In Chicago, John, I'm surrounded by aging, poorly maintained nuclear commercial power plants. It really is a very dangerous situation where if one of them, and their licenses keep getting extended, and there hasn't been a new nuclear power plant built in America, I think, since at least the 1970s. And if one of those plants goes down, if there's a Fukushima-type event, I don't expect a tsunami hitting Chicago, but or a hurricane, or an earthquake for that matter, but there could be some kind of a catastrophic event that would cause a nuclear meltdown. And I remember writing one of the first articles I ever wrote when I began that if Chicago was downwind and this type of event happens, Chicago residents on very short notice will get orders to evacuate, take whatever you can, and you may never be able to come home again. Well, I mean, this is the nightmare that I've thought about from time to time, and it's possible. But we remember the BP disaster in the Gulf. BP, They'll pay whatever they pay. They won't pay what they should pay, but it's the complicity of corporate and government negligence that lets this stuff happen. It happens over and over again, and you can have an incident, whether it's real or otherwise, where a couple of people get killed, and you can blame it on people you call terrorists. That makes headlines day after day, and the other stuff fades very fast.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know, but there are all sorts of articles on the internet about empty fishing nets in the Gulf of Mexico. I don't know whether you've looked at any of them or not. I mean, apparently that the oil has caused a lot more damage than anybody has said so publicly. But the government isn't saying anything. The news, the mainstream news, isn't saying anything. They don't care. They don't give a damn.
Oh, they don't care.
But one of the things that has really angered me over the last couple of days is that, you know, the Americans turned against the Vietnamese War when that photograph, which I'm sure you all remember, got splashed over all newspapers in America, that little girl covered in napalm, walking down the street. That one photograph turned Americans against the war. There are no photographs about the children being killed in America every day on television. None.
Let alone foreign war, John.
Single one. Well, yeah, but you know, how are we going to get action on violence in America if nobody ever sees the violence? I mean, you know, even the Chicago newspapers don't print pictures of all these kids who get killed in Chicago every week.
John, I've written that in Chicago, more than one person, on average per day, is killed by gun violence.
Yeah.
I'm
an old man, and I don't have the ability to do stuff anymore, and I'm going blind and all that kind of stuff. But I don't understand why nobody out there who has access to the internet, time and money, and a little bit of money, you know, that would I would take the pictures of the 12 or how many there were senators who voted against the background check law, okay, and I would surround pictures of them, each one of them, with pictures of dead kids who have been killed by guns since January, and I would plaster that stuff all over the internet, all over the country. But nobody will do that in America. They won't. I mean,
no, they won't, and you certainly wouldn't get a major publication or a television broadcast to show that stuff.
But even if you put it out, you know, and people started sending it around on their Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts or whatever, I don't know anything about that stuff. I don't have any of those accounts. But it becomes what they call viral. It could have some effect, but nobody will do it. So we have the guys who voted against the background checks on page 10, and we have whatever pictures you can find of the dead kids on page 510. And of course, nobody ever puts the two together. And they could do it. I'm ranting, and I don't like to rant.
I think what you're saying is important, John, because, I mean, there's a way to really arouse public concern and interest and anger, and there's another way to be sure that it doesn't get aroused. And the manipulators of news and information in America or other Western countries, I guess most others, they go considerably out of their way to be sure that the public does not get riled up against anything they can blame on their own government. So it's an old scheme.
Yeah, it's an old scheme. You want to talk about Benghazi? I've got some of this about Benghazi too.
Oh yeah, well, I wrote about Benghazi, but it's been a while, and I really haven't kept up with the congressional hearings and the rest of it. But maybe you can update me, John.
Well, you know, the administration released the emails that passed between members of the executive branch when they were concocting the talking points. Okay, and sure, you see all sorts of stuff. Yeah, they manipulated the talking points. Nobody, well, who cares? I mean, that's politics. But one of the things came out was that the facility attacked wasn't a diplomatic facility. It wasn't a consulate. It wasn't a minor diplomatic facility. It was a CIA operation that was secret to the point that even the Libyan government was never notified that it existed. So, somebody gets, hooed of what's going on and attacks it and kills whoever got killed, okay? And now what's the government going to do? Admit that they had a CIA secret facility in Benghazi? Of course they're not going to admit that. So they concoct talking points. And the talking points are, well, it was a demonstration, and it was this and that and whatever. You make up a story. The CIA didn't want anybody to know it was a secret CIA operation in Benghazi that the Libyan government didn't even know about. So, you have this kind of stuff, and then you have these congressmen screaming. And I say to myself, look, guys, you created this agency. You created this business about executive privilege and secrecy and top secrecy and all that kind of stuff. And then you want the government to be, transparent and tell the truth when something happens. That's a contradiction, guys. You can't have it. Either you want secrecy or you don't. But nobody is... all sorts of articles and pieces on TV have come out about the changes made to the talking points, but only one source that I have come across, even on the Internet, told the truth about this building being a CIA operation, secret CIA operation. And I say to myself, well, this is absurd. I mean, we're arguing about nothing here. But worse yet, there's that old aphorism, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me.
Oh, indeed.
The government in this country has been fooled by the CIA since the very beginning, over and over and over and over again. And what do they do when they want to find out what's going on somewhere? They ask the CIA. That's like asking an inveterate liar, what the truth is. I mean, and nobody in this country points this stuff out. You don't ask a liar to tell you what's going on somewhere. But we do.
Yeah, we sure do. I remember when I wrote about it, the reports talked about the U.S. consulate, I believe, in Benghazi. Well, America had no consulate in Benghazi. And CIA virtually operates everywhere. They don't wear a badge on their chest or whatever that says CIA. They don't have an ID in their pocket that says CIA. But they're involved. Their dirty hands are involved in all this kind of stuff. But this was a manipulated event, and it's still making headlines. And what doesn't make headlines is what America did to the Libyan people, just literally destroyed the country.
Well, of course not. I mean, what we did to the Iranian people, what the British did to the Syrian people, and the French did to the, Lebanese people or whoever. None of that ever comes out. I mean, that's the international community, I guess. I don't know.
The usual suspects,
and I'm part of I was once part of the conspiracy because I taught in colleges and universities in which the history departments never told the truth. And while I was a professor, I was too busy doing my own stuff to even point that out. Yeah.
Oh, I can understand that. I can understand that very well.
I can understand it too, but it was wrong. It was just wrong, and I don't know. I asked myself, this Cruz guy from Texas, the Senator Cruz, he has a law degree from Harvard. Mm. You know, President Obama, he has a law degree from Harvard. And I say to myself, what the hell are those guys teaching at Harvard that two guys like that can get degrees there?
I can tell you what law professor Francis Boyle, who has a Harvard law degree, says about Harvard, and he names names. He names names. He doesn't hold back. He's been on this program a number of times. A number of years ago, he wrote an article, and I don't remember the title, but it was something to the effect advising parents, don't send your children to Harvard Law School. It's a school of torturers. It justifies America committing torture. And he names people like Alan Dershowitz and others who literally justify the use of torture. Well, I didn't go to law school, John. I went across the river. Let's take a break.
Is that like going across the tracks?
I had a five-time job. John Cozy, talking about everything from economics to bomb blast to you name it. John, I love just having an array of things to talk about because, they can be breaking news. There are so many issues, world and national, important stuff, and it's great to go on air and be able to talk about things, including the latest stuff. It always bothers me that maybe if I finish a Sunday program and I'm off air and something important happens later today or Monday or whatever, and I don't get back on air until Friday to talk about it in this program. Well, sometimes it's just old news. Sometimes it continues, but it's great to be able to talk about the latest stuff, the most important things at any point in time with great guests like you.
Yeah, well, we had a victory this week.
Oh, a victory in what?
Rios Montt.
Oh, Rios Montt, yes, I remember him well.
Well.
Guatemala.
Yeah. Of course, it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory because he's 88 and he got sentenced to 80 years.
Oh, it's like going after the Nazi war criminals. You catch them 40 years after the fact.
Yeah.
I mean, they're 80, they're 90 years old. I mean, what's the point, John? What's the point?
Well, there's a point for him. The poor guards at Auschwitz or whatever, I feel sorry for them, but I don't feel sorry for Rios Montt.
Well, I agree. I certainly don't feel sorry for him or the other ringleaders, whether they're Nazis or Guatemalans or you name them. The ones that reside in Washington are the ones that bother me the most, John.
Yeah. You know what interested me with Margaret Thatcher's death the demonstrations and the Witch is Dead song and all that kind of stuff. Somebody pointed out that her progeny, her offspring, decided that they couldn't risk having her buried because they were afraid of people vandalizing her grave. So they decided to have her cremated.
Well, I didn't follow that. I didn't realize she was cremated.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, the article I read about this said, it ended but with a great line. It was something. She wasn't for changing, but she was for burning.
Yeah, the famous quote from her. This lady isn't for changing. Was that the exact quote?
Yeah.
No. This lady isn't for turning. For turning.
Well, whatever. Turning. Yeah, turning. But she's for burning. Yeah. That was a good line. The burning and turning. Yeah.
Well, the burning and the turning, indeed. I mean, I saw that this lady isn't for turning. I saw that so many times. I wrote one article about Thatcher, and I had to use that quote, of course.
I thought that, you know, somebody ought to tell Mr. Cameron that he may be for burning, too.
Well, he ought to be, but it doesn't matter whether it's Cameron, a Tory, or so-called New Labour.
But at least the British people who she so grievously injured had enough gumption to stand up and say so when she died. There was none of this crap about, you know, honoring the dead and don't speak bad of the dead or whatever. It was, she was a witch, and she we're glad she's gone.
Oh, she really was a witch. She just imposed some terrible hardships on the British people, and it's been all downhill since.
Yeah, I don't understand again why people don't see what was happening in Britain and take it up. I mean, Angela Merkel's doing the same damn thing in Europe.
Oh, absolutely, and she's a ringleader.
Yeah.
Britain is not part of the so-called Eurozone. You've got the EU. I forget how many countries are in the EU, but a lot more than are in the so-called Eurozone, 17 countries, and they're the Euro countries, the countries that all adopted the Euro and literally gave up their monetary and, to a large extent, fiscal authority to do so. So you've got an outside banker sitting in Brussels that decides the monetary and fiscal policy of these 17 countries. It's insanity, John, but this is the way the system works.
Yeah, it's insanity, but it's just one step removed from central banking. I mean, it's insanity, you know, for the United States Congress to have given control of the money to supply to a couple of economists and bankers sitting in Washington who are owned and bought and paid for by the banks.
Well, true enough, John.
Same thing completely. You know, how dumb could it be for a country to allow a private entities to create money, the country's money, and then have the country have to borrow it from the private entity and pay interest on it? I mean, what the heck did they have in mind? Of course, they didn't have anything in mind. They knew what they were doing. They were turning the country over to the Rothschild family and its scions. That's all there was to it. Central banking. I mean, Bernanke is an adopted son of the Rothschilds. That's all he is.
Yeah, something like that. An academic, John. I mean, there are a lot of academics who aren't noble, dare I say, noble Romans like you, John. I mean, most of them go in the tank for a buck.
Well, that's true. I'm not sure I would have resisted that either, except that I was in a profession that nobody was willing to give a buck to. I was a philosopher.
Well, that's right.
Philosophers don't command bucks.
I think Bernanke taught at Princeton, I guess economics.
Yeah, he's Princeton, yeah. Yeah,
he was an economic advisor to, was he a Bush and Obama economic advisor? I forget.
I don't know.
At least Obama. He became Fed chairman, I believe, in 2006. Yeah, he was a Bush economic advisor. Greenspan retired. He took over in 2006. Greenspan ducked out. He got out of the line of fire because he could see what was coming, and it did at the end of 2007. Bernanke took over, so he could come in and at least say, well, I didn't do it. Now I'm trying to put out the fire. Well, his idea of putting out the fire was to throw more fuel on it, and that's what's been happening. The bankers have done great. The corporations have done great. Ordinary people have really suffered.
Yeah, that was one of the points of my paper. You know, the whole, everything that's called economics is devised to protect and enhance the rentier class of people at the expense of people, other people. I mean, and that's the way it is. The law is that way. There was an article I was going to write about, but I didn't think it was significant enough. Somebody pointed out that one of the problems with unemployment is that home ownership locks people into houses. It makes it difficult for them to move to places where there are jobs. And he suggested that what we need is more renting and less home ownership. And I thought to myself, what kind of an idiot is this? You know, it's hard to get out of a rental contract, too, and you still have all if you're going to have to move to somewhere else, you either have to get rid of any property, personal property you have, or you have to pay to move it. And
John, I think it's tougher to get out of a rental agreement because if your home is underwater, and literally, I mean, you're just throwing good money after bad.
Yeah.
I remember writing about something that somebody called or somebody else identified as jingle mail. You literally mail the keys back to the mortgage holder and vamoose.
Yeah, but I thought to myself, this guy is so dumb, he doesn't realize that it's a lot simpler to just change the law governing contracts.
Oh, you sure could do that?
If you do that, you can make it easy for people to get out of contracts if you want to. I mean, no problem at all. But of course, the courts don't do that. A contract, I hate contracts. I mean, they are in the court's eyes sacrosanct. I mean, you sign a contract, it's on your shoulders forever. And everything changes but contracts. The economy goes up, the economy goes down, people get jobs, they lose jobs, they die, they get sick, they can't work, they get hurt. All that stuff changes, but what doesn't change? Any damn contract you signed.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, and that's absurd. But here this guy was suggesting that, well, you have to have less home ownership, more rentals, to solve this problem of the mobility of labor, when really all you have to do is change contract law. You don't have to do any of that. But he was an economist. He'd be too stupid to know what he was doing.
Well, again, the kind of talking head economists that tell people the wrong things. They don't explain things the right way. And they certainly don't promote the good things. They promote things that benefit themselves and benefit the corporate interests, the people that are funding them to pay their salaries and so on. And if you ally with the wrong side against the good people, it's a lot better paying than if you concentrate on doing what's right.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's the way, I mean, sure. But what I don't understand is how the world, people who really ought to know better, can't see that there's, with all the controversy that there is about everything in the community of economists, that they keep asking economists for advice. I mean, why in the world would you ask people that wrong for 250 years for advice? What kind of an idiot does that? A politician, I guess. I don't know.
Well, the politicians are benefiting, and certainly...
Oh, no. We know who's benefiting. People ask them for advice because they protect the status quo. That's why.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. I mean, people like you and me would never be invited on a major corporate-run radio or television program to discuss things the way we do on this program, John. I mean, the possibility of that is virtually zero. Zero.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't dare do it.
I had something. Banks are too big to fail, and I'm too small to be noticed.
Yeah.
I'm still, and nobody has come up with anything to make me think otherwise.
Oh, it certainly doesn't make me think otherwise. It's the same with so-called public radio and television in America. I have literally sat in the live studio of the Chicago affiliate of National Public Radio. I don't know whether the host of the program remembers me, but I met him, and I sat feet away from him, and a guest that I brought to him to put on the program, and he did. And I sat feet away from both of them, and I know that they know who I am. It's been some time, but one of the program's producers once contacted me from an article I wrote and asked me if I could help them get a certain guest on their program related to what I wrote about. Well, I don't like to ask to be interviewed. I like to be asked. But I just scratched and shook my head, and I said, what are they asking me help for to get somebody else on about this topic when I wrote about it and they read my article? Why didn't they invite me on?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
I'm in Chicago, John. I mean, I could waltz right into their studio. They wouldn't even have to call me on the phone.
That's right. Well, yeah, you know, Well, that's what I meant by you know, a little while ago. I said that when one group of people gets control of 90% or more of the world's resources, the rest of us don't have a chance. We don't. I mean, we don't have. You know, Obama goes on television and he says we need more scientists and engineers. Of course, he never specifies what kind of scientists or engineers he wants. And I wrote an article about that, too, something like, you know, what does he want? Anthropologists, maybe? Aren't they scientists? Sure,
well, he's
anthropologists. But the point was, I would ask him, I said, why do we need more scientists? We don't pay attention to the ones we have now.
Indeed.
You know, and I don't, what in the world is going through people's minds when he says that in a press conference and no reporter stands up and asks him that question? Why? What are these reporters with empty heads? Yeah, I guess they are, sure. I mean, what?
There's a daily press briefing, or an almost daily press briefing, by the State Department, and I like to go to it once in a while and quote the State Department representative on a topic that I may be writing an article on. I must say, John, that occasionally a reporter, not certain who it may be, how important the person is. A lot of people attend these press conferences. I don't think anybody gets invited if they ask embarrassing questions repeatedly. They don't want these people in there, or they're never called on. I think that's the most important thing. They're never called on, so they can be there representing a publication, but they'll never get a chance to ask a question. But occasionally, when a half-decent question is asked, you get a rotten answer, and if there's a redirect by the questioner, you get a second rotten answer, and then you move on to some other question, so you never get a good answer.
Asking the question, if you can ask it in an appropriate way, and that's obvious to everybody, you can at least embarrass the guy.
I guess if you embarrass them too badly, you'll never get invited.
Well,
back, John.
Okay, so you know, a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush.
Oh, indeed. Well, one more comment on Venezuela. I mean, it's been a good while since the election. There was absolutely legitimate, and there's a duly elected new president. So far, the Obama administration has yet to recognize the duly elected president of Venezuela. And in one of the press briefings, it was well over a week ago, State Department representative was pressed on this, and I remember his comment, and he repeated it several times, in terms of, are you planning to recognize this government? His comment was, he didn't give a yes or no answer, his comment was, quote-unquote, we're not there yet. Well, that was a pretty strong no for me.
Yeah, I mean, how many people in Central America have been supported by the United States government who are now persona non grata in their own countries. There's a whole slew of them. And you know, United States isn't gonna congratulate the Guatemalans for throwing Rios Mutt in jail, but they should.
No, they won't do it, John. They were complicit in his crimes, that's
of
for sure.
Of course they were complicit in his crimes. But again, you know, it's the kind of thing when we have a traitorous journalistic profession in this country. And when, you know, everything that's part of the status quo is traitorous when you read the Constitution. But, of course, not a single person in that group has the wherewithal to stand up and say so.
No, you don't get
none
it.
None of them. I mean, you know, and I watch these people on television. I say, what are they thinking? What kind of a damn fool? Some female anchor woman interviewed the girl who was arrested in Italy and for the murder and cleared, now being charged again or whatever. She gets around and says, did you kill her? Well, what do you expect her to say, stupid? Yeah, I mean, how do you get information out of a person by asking stupid questions like that?
No, you don't, John.
I remember. I think it was the same news person interviewed Ahmadinejad, and asked him. No, that was Barbara Walters, and she said, "Can you say that Iran will never, you know, develop or use an atomic bomb?" And I thought to myself, "What ever?" Who knows what's going to happen 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years from now? Ever? Who wrote that question? What kind of a stupid question was that? You know, but that's the kind of thing you get from it. That's entertainment. She was trying to say, oh, I got him. He couldn't say yes. That's all it was.
Well, it's pretty shocking that most people confuse what they read in the papers, John, or hear on television with news and information. I mean, the two have absolutely no connection with each other. And most people rely on this stuff. I think the numbers are going down. I think the ratings for so-called TV news programs are going down. I just can't imagine why anyone wastes their time watching them.
Well, it's noise. I mean,
I guess it's noise.
That's why the TV's on in our house all the time, because my wife likes noise. And she said, I don't want to hear noise. Oh, okay. I'll put noise on television. Put CNN on. There's lots of noise there. that's okay. I keep saying, why don't you play the radio or something? No, it's not the right kind of noise.
Well, you got lots of channels, John. I guess you can switch from one to another, and different things for different people. It's amazing how much stuff is on, and it's amazing how little of it is worth watching, if any.
Yeah, none of it is. I want to get a few minutes here, don't we?
Oh, I think we've got about 1 or 2 minutes left, so I'm going to let you.
Okay, I was just going to say things in my paper that people ought to be aware of Bernstein, who's on television a lot, says that
Jared Bernstein.
Too little inflation. What he wants inflation for is because employers can reduce the salaries of their employees by giving raises that are less than the rate of inflation, and he thinks that's a great thing. And then there's the paradox of thrift, which economists say saving is good for a consumer individually, but it's not good for the economy when consumers save. And what is good for this, the spending that's good for the economy is bad for consumers. And I said that, you know, if you put both those two things together, it becomes logically impossible for capitalists to function for the benefit of all people.
And the most important thing is that he is an Obama administration advisor.
Well, yeah. But
John, we are out of time. The music alerts me.
Fat lady singing.
John, I look forward to getting you back next month, and I hope listeners will tune in because we're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and weekends Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit. Tune in for wonderful guests like John. Thanks, John.
See you there.